You are listening to 100.5 FM CFRO, Vancouver's Co-op Radio, broadcasting live from the downtown east side on unceded Coast Salish territories. Today is J11. It's January 11th, and it has been labeled a global day of solidarity with the I Don't Know More movement, and I'll be chatting a little bit about that later. Just wanted to acknowledge that right off the bat. This is Animal Voices, and we are a program which airs weekly, which talks about animal rights and animal advocacy and protection and vegan issues and events and news, and offers interviews and such. And today, my name's Alyssa Ray, and I'm joined in studio by Jackie,
hello,
my co-host. And Tim is on the controls today.
Hello.
And Allison's over there helping
us
as well. Yeah, so we're all here today. Let's see, what do we have? We are going to talk about an upcoming event tomorrow night happening at Rhizome, a film screening.
Mm. Are we all going to be there?
I'm a little bit on the fence. There's a lot going on that night, but I really do want to go. So hopefully, yes. And Jackie's
going. I'll be there, yeah.
Good, good. So, yeah, we'll have Maya on the phone soon to give the details about that very shortly. And then later in the show, after the halfway mark, we're going to be talking to the author of an essay called Veganism and Mi'kmaq Legends, Feminist Natives Do Eat Tofu. That's Margaret Robinson, PhD. She'll be on the phone from Toronto. I'm just discussing that essay she wrote, and we look forward to that. And we'll also offer, of course, the news and events as usual. Thank you so much for joining us today. To kick things off, I don't know, I was just kind of thinking of, I haven't done much research, but I did notice that I guess Paul Watson has stepped down as the captain of the Sea Shepherd.
It's pretty big news. When did that happen?
I don't know, this week sometime. I actually didn't read that much details about it. Just I kind of saw Liberation BC reposted it. So he's no longer the head of Sea Shepherd because of the, injunctions. He's not allowed to, be within 500 meters of a Japanese whaling ship, or he could get in trouble again. And I guess for the animals, if he wants Sea Shepherd to continue and not keep getting in trouble, he has to take probably a background role. So I'm not sure if he'll still be
he's still officially
involved.
In hiding though, right?
No.
Okay, I was wondering about that.
Probably about a month ago,
because he did post a Christmas picture of a group photo. I was like, is that recent?
Yeah, I think it was about a month ago that he came out of hiding. And then so this is before, I don't think the Sea Shepherd campaign has started yet quite this year. It was kind of like, we're back, we're ready to do it again, but now he's stepping down.
We know if one of the other crew members is stepping up to take this role?
I don't know that that's been announced yet. If it has, well, I'm not doing a good job of staying on top of my news, but...
of their ships have separate captains.
Right.
He's only captain of one of them.
Yeah, that's true. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, and so I'm sure, the campaigns will continue. The Whale Wars show will probably continue, I wonder. He's such a charismatic leader and makes for such great TV. I don't know.
That was the number, and still maybe the number one show on Animal Planet.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow, awesome.
And I'm curious to know, is Paul Watson still in danger of being taken back to Costa Rica, it is, right, to basically stand on trial?
So we'll look into that. And let's see, I just kind of wanted to mention, a couple events coming up. We are co-sponsoring officially the Animal Advocacy Camp this year in February, at the end of February. Jackie, you have some details on that?
Yeah, so that will be February 23rd and 24th from 9 to 5. The venue has been changed, but it's to be announced. So we don't know exactly where it's going to be yet, but that will be listed on their website, animaladvocacycamp.ca. And also you can join the Animal Advocacy Camp Facebook page to keep in touch.
I'm super excited about that, and I'm excited to be sponsoring it. We'll get to talk about Animal Voices at the camp, which is really great because we need to outreach to that community and make sure everyone in the Vancouver area at least knows about us. And we'll be doing a couple interviews, I guess, leading up to the Animal Advocacy Camp. I've been thinking about the camp because I remember last year they did this paper bag thing where you could put projects you wanted to start or get involved in, and people could put their contact info in who wanted to get involved. And I've just been like carrying around this list of names who are interested in this one thing. And I just recently, yesterday, I think I sent them all an email that was like, I'm not really doing this, but here's some other people who are, and you could probably get involved with them. So.
Okay. Can you talk a bit about what
I've just been thinking about, the importance of an activist support circle. So sort of the yin side of activism. We're often doing so much that's like out there and it's really takes a lot of energy and it's a lot of action is needed. But what about like sort of the self-care to like keep it sustainable and just sharing with other people who are also struggling with the same things, because we can often feel so alone and so weighed down by all the information we're taking in and all the sad facts.
Exactly. And as we talked about last week, you know, self-care is equally as important if you want to help the animals. So
yeah, definitely. Speaking of events, we have with us on the phone Miss Maya Mayhem. She is organizing an event tomorrow night, and I think tonight as well. That's Saturday, January 12th in the evening at Rhizome Cafe, a film screening and a talk about the fur industry. And they're joining us on the phone now.
Hi there.
Oh, hey, Maya, it's good to talk to you.
Good to talk to you, too.
Yeah, thanks so much for joining us today. I just kind of wanted to put an extra highlighter mark on this event because I just think it's these kinds of events are so important, and I really believe in the power of film to get across the message. I think we've all been touched by particular
Definitely,
films.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about the film you're screening tomorrow evening.
Okay, great. So we're going to screen Bold Native, and Bold Native is a fictitious true-to-life account of animal liberation activists, some of the struggles that they go through, state persecution, and their quest to save the animals. And the really nice thing about this film is because these are things that people can't really talk about. You know, people can't really talk about things that go on in the underground, one, because, you know, they'll get in a lot of trouble, it's illegal, it's socially unacceptable. So when you put something like that in film, it gives people a chance to kind of to discuss these ideas and to discuss kind of the stuff that goes around behind closed doors without facing any persecution and anything like that.
Yeah, it really kind of humanizes the often, I don't know, yeah, it is kind of a very mysterious sort of thing. Like, who are these people behind the black masks? And I don't understand and I don't relate or like, it's, I watched Bold Native recently and found it to be, I think anyone could kind of relate to those sort of struggles, the kind of how can we like trust each other and I wonder, I did actually see another film recently about the ALF, but it was a documentary by
Was it the ALF one? Like, it's just called ALF?
It was by Shannon Keith of ARMY, or the Animal Rights Media Education. Yeah, I was just kind of curious about, like, either showing a documentary or a fictional story. How did you kind of make that decision?
My partner Tim, who's doing the event with me, his friends created Bold Native, so we really wanted to show some support and get it screened up here, because I don't think it's been screened up here yet. I could be wrong.
I don't think it has been, because it's been on my radar for a long time, and I know you can watch it online, but, you know, you just never do that. So I'm really looking forward to going to this, actually, to see your talk, but to see the film as well, because it has been on my to-do list for a long time, and when you announced that, it's like, perfect, I'm going to go see that, because I've heard it's a really fantastic film.
It is.
I've also not seen it, so I'm excited for that as well.
great.
Yeah, definitely. And then, so you're following up the film with a talk. Can you tell us a bit about what you'll be talking about?
Yeah, we're actually going to start with the talk, and that way, if anybody has any questions, they can address it right away.
Yeah.
So the talk is about dismantling the fur industry, and we recently did it down in LA at the Long Beach Animal Rights Forum. So it's kind of an overview about the horrors of the fur industry, and we don't go into too much detail because a lot of people know about that, but we talk about some effective campaigning, because there's a lot of stuff that we can do around the fur industry. We talk about debunking some myths, and I know one of the myths that you asked me to talk about was the myth that the fur industry supports indigenous communities. And, you know, today being a huge day of action with Idle No More, I thought that it'd be, I think that it's a really great idea to talk about that. Less than 2% of the money earned in the fur industry goes to indigenous trappers. It's actually serves to be like yet another thing that's been colonized by Western capitalist forces. You know, people have gotten in there and they've taken that away. And though I don't condone the killing of any animal ever, I'm not going to argue against subsistence hunting when there's big, huge capitalist forces to fight. I think it's the quote that I've read recently is it's $400 a year is the amount.
I read that too.
Thank you, Fur Bear Defenders, for being an awesome resource.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's not a sustainable practice, and it's not anything that bumps up the communities.
Mm-hmm. So it's essentially a non-argument when people say that you should support the fur industry because you need to support the indigenous peoples.
Yeah, and I mean, in fact, it takes away from their communities because, I mean, a lot, and I am a Caucasian female, so I can't really, I do speak from a position of privilege, and I can't speak for anybody, like any of the indigenous communities, but from my perspective, they have lived in harmony with the animals for so long, and going in there and eradicating all the species is taking away from those communities because their ecosystems are thrown off balance. And, the means that they need to sustain life are being taken away.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, makes sense to me. I think, that's a big myth out there. And it's really important that we kind of work to smash that myth. And
absolutely.
What are some of I actually wanted to ask, why
sure.
the fur industry? Why are you focusing specifically on that industry?
It's really on the rise right now. I don't know about numbers, so I can't specifically say how much of a rise it's taken, but everywhere that I look, I see people with fur trim and I see people being fooled. The laws in Canada don't regulate the branding of fur. So if it's fur trim, if it's gloves, if it's scarves, toques, any of this stuff, it doesn't have to be labeled as fur. So people are going in and thinking that they're buying synthetic products and thinking that they're not they're not contributing to the animal cruelty, but really it's raccoon dogs, it's cats, it's dogs, it's fox, it's mink, it's all of these animals that people don't want to hurt, but they're being fooled.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it seems like it's such kind of a niche industry or kind of small that it can actually maybe be toppled with focused tactics.
And it has, Speaking of focused tactics, there's a really great, and I can't remember the name of the first store. I think it's not Unger, but it's another one in Portland. But so there was a long campaign at that first store where people just went every day, and they yelled through bullhorns, and they gave people leaflets, and they talked about the cruelty of the fur industry. And that first store is now closed, which is fantastic. And I think that these things can happen. These are realistic goals that we can achieve. If we just keep pressure on these stores, because they aren't sustainable. Their industries rely on people being fooled. And, I think that we can put a stop to that.
So when you speak of dismantling the fur movement, are you speaking of the matter of going to these stores and literally getting them shut down as a way to dismantle the industry?
I like to these things happen on so many different levels, and it depends where people are at, whether it's, community education. So talking about talking to the workers at these fur farms because they're also horribly oppressed, talking about them and their rights, talking to people about the environmental destruction that happens through the process of fur, talking about people just taking a stand and not buying it and not supporting those stores and actually asking those stores to leave their communities. There's so many things that we can do, and there's so many different levels that we can work on to stop this horrible practice.
Yeah. Did you have a question?
Yeah, I was just wondering if you could chat a bit about your thoughts on the whole, like, Fur is Green campaign and website, because I think a lot of people are still, like, living under this myth or thinking that it's more green than synthetics.
It's true, and I hear this argument at every demo that we go to. There's always somebody who walks up and is like, you know, your vegetarian boots are more destructive than anything else. But, I mean, it is a lie, because those the chemicals that are used in fur production are so harmful for the environment. You know, it takes a lot of toxic materials to make fur, a natural living source, live off of an animal's body. So you think about all that. That all goes into the environment, all the leather tanning, all mm-hmm. fur tanning. Then there's just the animal waste. You know, when you have a concentration of 50,000 animals, there's going to be a huge influx of animal waste. And put just into the environment, into the waterways, it's toxic. There's algae blooms that are created from this toxicity in the water systems, and that goes along to kill fish and to kill all sorts of wildlife within the water systems.
Yeah, thanks for highlighting that, and thanks for asking, Jackie. Yeah. I'm just curious to talk about now why you organized this event and what sort of I saw that you're fundraising for a particular charity.
Yeah.
Tell us about that.
Okay. So we organized it, I mean, one, because we really want to see a lot more action. And there's been a huge rise of action in Vancouver lately. There's a lot of really great groups going to stores and doing community engagement and talking to people about what's going on. So that's on the rise, which is fantastic. So we thought it would be a perfect time to do this fur talk. We've been offered this amazing opportunity to move to Costa Rica and co-run an animal sanctuary.
Wow.
So, yeah, it's incredible. We were actually just looking to go somewhere and volunteer and try to see if we could maybe move somewhere and start our own animal sanctuary, but we found this place called Rainsong Wildlife Sanctuary in Costa Rica, and they need people. The woman who's running it right now is facing some illness, and she's not able to keep going. With the amount of work that it takes to run this place. So she's asked for help, and she's asked for help in raising donations as well, because with the economies around the world, a lot of the volunteers aren't coming anymore because they can't afford it. So, you know, she wants a breath of fresh air in there. She needs some help with the infrastructure, so building new shelters for animals, with the animal food, and just kind of like all our upkeep and maintenance of the shelter. So, yeah, so we're throwing this event to raise funds for that. We're trying to raise about $5,000 before we go. So this event is one of a few that we're going to do to try to raise that.
When will you be heading over there, Maya?
February, like, 19th, I think.
Wow, that's coming up really soon. That's
yeah.
exciting.
Oh, it's amazing. It's a dream come true.
Oh, have you ever been there to Costa Rica before?
No, neither of us have been. I've been around the world to a number of different animal sanctuaries, but I think this one will be really neat. I'm really excited about this one.
Yeah, that sounds amazing. Like, best of luck. And maybe you
Thank
could just
you.
Mention your how people might be able to donate if they want to.
Sure, yeah. I wish I had the direct link, but we've got an Indiegogo page, and it's Help Rainsong Sanctuary Save Costa Rican Wildlife. Is a little bit long, but if you were to look up on Indiegogo and just type in Rainsong Sanctuary, I think you could find it.
We could put the link on our website, too.
Oh, yeah. That sounds
yeah.
great. Okay,
yeah, for
thank
sure.
You. Awesome. And we're doing the event tomorrow night at Rhizome, and it starts at 7. And then we're also, for anybody who's listening from Victoria, we're going to do the same event there on Thursday, January 16th at 6:30 p.m. at Canis Bookstore.
Nice. Actually, you mentioned Rhizome. I just kind of wanted to ask, I see that I think Black Paw Print Collective, which you're part of, has hosted a couple events at Rhizome. And
yeah.
I just wanted to ask sort of how that relationship began and why Rhizome.
Rhizome's fantastic because they really, really support community engagement. And they're fantastic in their support with kind of grassroots movements, with a variety of different struggles, and just like you know, the way that their restaurant works, they have a community soup pot. So if anybody's hungry, they can come, and for whatever they've got, they can have some delicious lentil stew. And it's really accessible and really open for events especially. It's they're just really welcoming. So I think we started doing them last year at some point. And just by chance, we were looking for spaces that could host events because, you know, in Vancouver, these things are really limited. The city cracks down on any kind of free space. And Rhizome was so accommodating for us. And, yeah, we really want to support them.
Good. Yeah, thanks for that. I kind of actually just wanted to mention, because I'm a fan of Rhizome as well, just what their name means. So
oh, yeah.
I'm just looking at their website. It says, in the botanical sense, a rhizome is a root system that some plants, like lilies and orchids and ginger and bamboo, use to spread themselves about. While the roots of most plants point generally downward, the rhizome is a horizontal root system that runs parallel to the surface of the ground. The plant sends shoots up from nodes in the rhizome, creating what look like many separate plants. These seemingly unrelated individuals are actually all connected through a system that's not immediately visible to the eye. Yeah.
That's beautiful.
I just really like that.
Yeah. And that really speaks to being a community and to being in solidarity with one another, because we've got to, you know, for all of these struggles, whether it's, you know, whether people that are concerned about the animals or the environment or social justice, feminism, you know, all of these struggles are all related, and we need to work together to achieve them.
Yeah, definitely. And even like a space like Rhizome, it isn't necessarily vegan, but they're very vegan friendly and supportive.
Yep.
Yeah, so I guess that's about all we have time to talk about today. I just wanted to thank you so much for joining us. And
thank you.
I look forward to seeing you tomorrow.
Yeah, I'm wishing you the best of luck with your fundraising. And yeah, I hope you get that $5,000 you're looking for, and happy journeys.
Thank you so much.
Okay.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
So you are listening to 100.5 FM CFRO, Vancouver's Cooperative Radio. And I have a couple news items to let you guys know about. So I'm sure most of you listeners probably have heard of this, but the public is warned of an animal torturer living in Vancouver. On Monday, BC Corrections released Kayla Burke from Alouette Correctional Center for Women, but policy prevents the agency from revealing her location, even though she's deemed a high risk to reoffend due to an escalating criminal history. Burke was convicted of causing unnecessary pain, suffering, or injury to animals, willfully and without lawful excuse, killing animals and purposing a weapon for a dangerous purpose. Burke received an 8-month sentence. Guidelines prevented a longer sentence, and since she isn't psychotic, she can't be detained under the Mental Health Act. The Vancouver Police Department's High-Risk Offenders Unit will closely monitor her. And she must also follow 46 court-ordered conditions, including psychological counseling and zero contact with animals or people under the age of 18. Another news story that we actually talked about earlier before the show is about the orcas that were freed from ice in northern Quebec. So after being trapped under thick layers of sea ice for over 3 days, a pod of killer whales swam to open water near a fishing village in northern Quebec early Thursday. The 12 whales became stranded Monday after huge sections of ice shifted behind them while they were migrating in the Hudson Bay along Quebec's northeastern coast. About 25 kilometers of ice separated the group from open water, causing locals to wonder if an ice-breaking ship would be needed to clear a path for the killer whales. Fortunately, a strong wind came in from the northeast late Wednesday night, and it cracked a huge section of the ice, allowing orcas to escape. But Allison was mentioning earlier that we're not certain exactly where the whales ended up.
For the latest news that I heard this morning is the people have been looking for the whales and haven't been able to find them, and the ultimate bottom line is that this isn't a good area for killer whales to be in at this time of the year, and there's just really not a lot of space for them to swim freely around. From what you were saying, is they're migrating, right?
Yeah.
So they're just passing through, and unfortunately they've been stuck in this area where there's all these ice flows, so it's unfortunate that I think that this might continue to happen unless they do reach safety somehow.
So another item is Taiwan is joining seal product ban. So Newfoundland and Labrador have one less country to which it can export seal products. On January 8th, Taiwan made amendments to existing legislation that would effectively ban exports and imports of live marine mammals and associated products such as fur and oil. The law will be implemented by the end of January at the earliest. And this is one of the fourth largest importer of seal oil. So that's going to definitely affect the Canadian seal hunt, and hopefully with Taiwan joining the United States, Russia, and the European Union, hopefully that will help to put an end to this barbaric practice.
And I, as I said at the beginning, I was going to talk a little bit about January 11th, the Global Day of Solidarity with the Idle No More movement and with the struggle of Indigenous people in general. This has been a very intense week for me, doing a lot of self-reflection and questioning where I'm coming from in showing solidarity and what that means. As a settler whose grandparents came from Europe to this land, there are no treaties on the land that we are on, and being aware of that fact, it's an uncomfortable reality for settlers and non-Native people. I've just been struggling with that all week, and I just kind of wanted to share that just personally. How vulnerable it can be, and how strange and disconcerting when you put yourself in that place of, okay, like, what is my place at these protests and rallies, and I want to show my support, but how do I do that? So so I wanted to kind of show solidarity on the show, inspired by a piece, or by the Vegan Police. They're a group out of Toronto, and their article is called "Animal Liberationists Should Support Idle No More." And the author basically said, it's not a question, it's a moral imperative. We must show support. And they were pointing out that Native peoples across Turtle Island, or North America as it's known, have been confronting capitalism and speaking out about environmental destruction and trying to protect the land, the water, and the animals for centuries. They're speaking up against tar sands, fracking, pipelines, tailing ponds, all these really destructive practices which lead to, you know, devastating effects for the land and for the animals which inhabit Canadian lands. And I just kind of wanted to share a bit of a quote from that. So, although First Peoples communities have been fighting factory farms, pollution, sport hunting, habitat destruction, and more for centuries, animal liberationists have largely failed to recognize shared struggle and join in solidarity. Too frequently, the focus is put upon whether or not people are vegan and whether or not people hunt other animal species. This has seen animal liberationists focus on domesticated farmed animals while turning their back on large environmental struggles and wildlife. This needs to end, according to the Vegan Police. Even if Native peoples were intent on animal use, their claim to this land is just, and the treaties which our ancestors signed are living, breathing documents. A response to oppression should be based on nothing other than a recognition of justice. Their struggle and their criminalization demands a response of solidarity. So ever since reading that article about a week ago, I've really just kind of wondered, what does solidarity look like? And then actually I went to a workshop with Jackie and a bunch of other amazing people. It was a yoga workshop, well, framed under the umbrella of yoga, which was called Sacred Justice: From Charity to Solidarity. You know, a lot of people are inclined to live a moral life or under some kind of spiritual practice to offer service, to offer their energy in service to others. And usually this service is offered to those seen as less fortunate. Service work like that is often well-intentioned, we learned in the workshop or talked about, but it can function to reinforce power dynamics that keep people in a position of receiving charity rather than empowerment, meaningful connection, and liberation. So in the workshop, we brainstormed on the meaning of power and privilege and oppression and what it means to be an ally. And we did a hands-on exercise which demonstrated that we have shared oppressions and what horizontal solidarity might look like.
It was a wonderful workshop. It basically was the definition of the rhizome that you described earlier.
Yeah, it was amazing. So I just kind of wanted to just say, yeah, like, it's up to every person individually to look at what it means and how to be an ally responsibly. And there are a lot of resources out there, and we all have to do our research about, you know, the land that we're on, about Canadian history and Indigenous history, and really, you know, humble yourselves and recognize your own privilege on this land and keep it in check and come from that place when building solidarity or when trying to show support to other movements. So I just wanted to give a call out to idlenomore.ca. That's a great place to get information. There's a lot in the media that's not really, you know, coming from the source. So I suggest people go there and remember that it's a grassroots, leaderless movement, not based just on Chief Teresa Spence and her work. You know, her actions are amazing, but it's not just about that. It's a people's movement. So yeah, I've learned a lot, and I encourage others to do your own learning. Yeah. And I'm going to play a song here by a tribe called Red. This is a song called The Road. They're an Aboriginal DJ crew based out of Ottawa. I'm a big fan. And this is their song in solidarity with Idle No More. So that was just a clip from a tribe called Red and their song called The Road. And I just kind of wanted to say, if you want to look up more, there is lots of resources. There's groups on Facebook. There's one called Settlers in Support of Indigenous Rights and Idle No More for settlers who seek to be allies in the movement for Indigenous rights and sovereignty, building a holistic foundation in the fight for all human rights. And yeah, just even Googling Decolonization Canada brings up a lot of great articles, including one called Decolonizing Together, Moving Beyond a Politics of Solidarity Toward a Practice of Decolonization by local activist Harsha Walia, who's a South Asian immigrant and an organizer of solidarity movements. So yeah, just kind of seeding that and hoping people do their own research and come from an uncomfortable place, and kind of own that.
And this is something that affects all Canadians too. So, yeah, it's important that everyone's aware what's going on.
Yeah, and this is about a nation to nation conversation, not necessarily about what's happening today. Prime Minister Harper talking to some chiefs and leaders. That's not what it's about. No. It's a long term movement, from my understanding, and. And yeah, we all need to unlearn and relearn and just totally check where we're coming from. So, yeah, moving on to our guest. So I just wanted to say, I tried to find a guest who would, an organizer of the Idle No More sort of protests and rallies this week, and I wasn't able to, and I think it just relates sort of to where my questions were coming from, that, I mean, maybe I think they were just a little bit too basic, because the information is available on the website. And anyway, I'm very happy about the guest that I have today. I had contacted her a few weeks ago, because after reading her essay, Veganism and Mi'kmaq Legends, Feminist Natives Do Eat Tofu. This is Margaret Robinson. She's a feminist scholar and bisexual activist based in Toronto. She holds a PhD from the University of St. Michael's College at the University of Toronto. Thank you for joining us, Margaret.
Thanks for having me.
Very welcome. So first, if you could give a bit of background on the Mi'kmaq peoples and sort of your place there and kind of where you're coming from.
Sure. The Mi'kmaq are the indigenous people of Nova Scotia, Prince Edward Island, and also parts of Newfoundland, Quebec, and Maine. There's a little over 60,000 of us. Personally, my grandmother came from the Lennox Island Reserve on Prince Edward Island and eventually moved her family to Halifax. And that's where I grew up, there in Nova Scotia. And traditionally, the Mi'kmaq hunted, fished, and gathered for food. They were nomadic, moving from one location to another and setting up camp wherever the food tended to be plentiful.
Mm-hmm. Did you grow up sort of in Mi'kmaq, like, community and in a reserve or in a city, or just kind of curious?
I guess it depends. We grew up on the land, I guess you would say, but not in reserve community. I grew up in a small area called Sheet Harbor, and while there was a reserve there, although we would visit it, most people didn't realize it was a reserve. We grew up on land that my father had bought with his siblings, and for most of our lives, being Native didn't really seem that significant because we weren't status Natives, so we didn't have access to a lot of that on-reserve culture that people did. Mm-hmm. My parents were politically involved. They wrote for Native newspapers. They were involved in Native politics, but as non-status people.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. And you are sort of status now?
I am, yeah. because of the Sharon MacIver lawsuit, actually. Mm-hmm. Yeah, my generation of family members gained our status that way.
Mm-hmm. When was that? Just curious.
Oh, I think I got my card only about a year and a half ago.
Oh, yeah, interesting. And then there was another recent ruling about status, which is really exciting, which gave a whole thousands of people, I think, are going to be claiming it soon.
Well, it creates a problem for many of the bands that people are going to want to join,
right?
Because they have cultures that they've developed over a really long period of time, and suddenly a lot of people like myself, who maybe grew up in a very different but equally Native culture, may flood them with requests for belonging. So that's going to be a challenge.
Mm, interesting.
Conflicting experiences of Native authenticity.
Right, yeah. Something to think about. I hadn't really before. So just to start to get into this essay that you wrote again, I guess it was a while ago, but I found it online, called Veganism and Mi'kmaq Legends, Feminist Natives Do Eat Tofu. So veganism is often seen as like a white phenomenon. I wonder what that means for someone who identifies as Native and indigenous vegan such as yourself.
Well, on a practical level, it can make it really difficult to participate in Aboriginal events. Mm. For instance, I went to a sweat lodge, and when they have the feast, most of the dishes that they serve aren't vegan. There's a lot of traditional meat-heavy dishes, so I end up eating a lot of wild rice and bannock, which is sort of the carbohydrates of our people. Similarly, while I'd like to participate in some of the drumming circles that are available in my area through the friendship centers, the vast majority of the drums are made with animal products. I've considered trying my hand at trying to produce a vegan drum, but frankly, I suspect I'd get laughed at if I brought it to circle. So some of the issues around that, of not wanting to have to explain and justify everything, can serve to exclude me from activities I'd like to participate in.
Mm-hmm. And also, I guess it's kind of seen as a thing of privilege that it, I don't know, that, can you just talk to the vegan and privilege idea a bit?
Sure. The association, the stereotype that only people who have lots and lots of disposable income can afford to be vegan. I grew up poor. We struggled often to have enough money for food. And so I understand the idea that, you know, if you're strapped for cash, you buy the things that are inexpensive. But I think the assumption behind that is that vegan food is going to be really expensive. I think if you look at lots of cultures around the planet, you'll find that many of the least expensive foods, the beans, the rice, these things are, they're often, they take a lot of activity, a lot of personal sweat equity, so to speak, to prepare, but they're not exactly expensive. They're not highly processed foods. But despite this, in terms of identity for Indigenous people, being vegan means that people will sometimes interpret that choice as evidence of assimilation, that it's assumed to be this sort of position that white privileged people take on.
Mm. Yeah, interesting. And I'm just wondering now, just kind of in your opinion, what do you think the effects are of non-Native people who reject ethical vegetarianism or veganism by portraying the consumption of animals as something intrinsic to First Peoples cultures, or the Mi'kmaq being one example of those?
Well, I'm pretty suspicious of that kind of thing,
mm-hmm.
Especially when it sounds like they're trying to freeze First Nations cultures in time and hold us into some sort of mold of the archetypal primordial man that they then use to justify their own choices. I mean, the truth is my ancestors ate meat. For many years, I ate meat. We weren't really into farming like a lot of other nations were, but the Mi'kmaq food culture emerged in a particular context, and that context is vastly different from my context today. You know, I live in the internet age. I live in downtown Toronto. So I resent it when white people try to tell me that Aboriginal authenticity means recreating exactly the circumstances in which my ancestors lived. Like, they're not living like the Pilgrims, so I don't really see why. It makes me suspicious that they want to freeze First Nations cultures in antiquity.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's almost I want to relegate you to the past or something.
It kind of assumes that it's natural that we will die out, and that is some sort of inevitable tragedy that must occur. A lot of it sort of speaks to me of the stereotype of the magical Indian as this sort of at one with all of nature and the animals and the ecological hunter. And that's a stereotype. Like, it's there's nothing particularly ecological about being a Native person.
I'm curious what you think about the rights for Indigenous people to, in Canada, for example, as we were speaking about earlier on the show, to go out hunting and to practice that so-called right they have. As you were saying, that's a very traditional, historical thing that Indigenous people have been doing in the past. Is that something that you feel should be continued to today? As you were saying, traditions changing, cultures change, and times are changing. What do you think about that?
I think it's really two different issues. The first issue is treaty rights. And the fact is that those are the treaty rights that were agreed to. It's sort of like a contract. You can say, well, that aspect of the contract didn't take into account what was going to happen with the ecology or with the fishing industry mm-hmm. down the road. And, of course, it didn't. But the fact is that that's what was agreed to. And so when you attempt to renegotiate those, you need to think about not only what did that mean for the people that negotiated the treaty in the first place? What were they trying to ensure by asking for those by making those demands as part of the agreement? But you also need to think about what are people's context now and what kinds of needs do they have now? When my ancestors negotiated for hunting and fishing rights, they were looking for future subsistence and to make sure that they had access to food.
Right.
I think there are lots of things you could replace that with if you were going to renegotiate the treaty. But to try to just undermine those treaty rights without being willing to negotiate what the Canadian side of that agreement is going to get. Like, no one's looking at giving back any of the land in exchange for those treaty rights. That's one issue. Is there was a document that was arranged, there was an agreement that was made, if people are going to renegotiate that, they need to do so on both sides. The second issue is hunting and fishing as an activity. The treaty was intended to make sure that people didn't starve. It wasn't really intended to make sure we could participate in a wholesale economic collection of fish, to run a business. That really wasn't the intention. I think there's a difference between people who want to hunt as individuals for food and people who want to, say, participate in large-scale fishery operations.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact is, we don't really need to do that to survive. Like, there are lots of other options now.
Yeah, actually, that let's take that and look at kind of the Mi'kmaq legends and kind of the legends about hunting and the original morals and ethics in your stories and relate that to today and how those are different. If you could talk a bit about that.
Sure. For me, I feel that veganism is an appropriate expression of my Mi'kmaq cultural values, such as the sacred value of animal life, the importance of land. I look at the relationships that I see in some of our legends, and I specify some because they're not all lovely. And I ask myself, how would I express that value today in my current location with the resources I have at hand? And for me, the practice of being vegan came before its indigenous connection was clear to me. I think some practices, such as meat eating, cut me off from certain realizations that opening myself up to how I'd been exploitative in my relationships with animals. And it enabled me to reconnect with aspects of my Mi'kmaq culture that hadn't seemed relevant before. So, for instance, the Mi'kmaq stories portray animals as people. They have personalities. Religiously, you might say they have souls. And the Creator cares about them, and Glooskap cares about them. So I have to ask myself, how would I show that caring in my own relationship to the earth and to animals? And so for me, the combination of animals as people with their own right to life and the accessibility of food that isn't animal-based means that eating animals isn't really necessary for survival and may actually undermine the values that we have as an indigenous nation.
Mm-hmm. And Allison had mentioned hunting in specific. Can you talk about kind of the relationship between the hunter and the hunted in Mi'kmaq stories? Just to highlight kind of how that might be different back then to now.
Well, for people who don't know, who aren't familiar with Mi'kmaq stories, we have a character called Glooskap, and he's sort of the prototype of the human being. He's sort of our, he's a bit like a superhuman being. He's sometimes sort of a Jesus figure, but he also represents the Mi'kmaq people as a whole. He represents humanity. And he's friends with all the animals. Initially, it doesn't seem like he needs to eat food at all. But when his grandmother is created, she tells him that she needs meat to survive. So his relationship with the animals changes. He asks his friend Martin to give up his life so that Glooskap's grandmother can live. And similarly, he asks the fish to sacrifice themselves to feed his relatives. The animals don't have to do it, but they do it out of love for Glooskap. The Creator didn't just give Glooskap a menu and tell him to have whatever he wanted. They sacrifice themselves out of friendship, and Glooskap is actually upset about this. And their choice to die in order to feed his family is contingent on them, on the family actually needing that. So in a Mi'kmaq context, if you don't need animal products to live, why would you ask your friends to kill themselves for you?
Mm-hmm. And I guess that seems to be what you're sort of pointing out, that modern practices of meat-eating might be more problematic and more colonial and oppressive than the practice of veganism, because it seems like we don't need animals to live as much, or most people don't, I would say.
Especially if you take a look at the way that meat production exists now. Mm-hmm. It's a very far cry between factory farming and tracking an animal through the woods and selecting one that isn't going to interrupt the life cycle of the animal population as a whole. Like, you don't take a pregnant animal, for instance, or you don't take a baby. I mean, the difference between hunting in that context historically and the meat production industry, it's night and day.
Yeah, actually, and I wish we had more time. I wish I had given more time to discuss this. And can you just share some advice for non-native vegans about how they can support indigenous struggles?
Oh, sure. Well, the truth is most First Nations people don't hunt and trap. Like everyone else, we buy our food at a grocery store. And the difference between what's available and how much it costs varies widely. You look at a place like Attawapiskat, where a 3-pound bag of apples costs $16, which
wow.
is three times what it costs, even at a high-end supermarket where I live. Or you look at neighborhoods across Canada that don't have a proper grocery store because they have half a dozen fast food chains instead. For the most part, First Nations people aren't eating traditionally. We're not living off the land. Most of us are eating cheap, unhealthy food. I grew up eating bologna stew. The way we've been eating as a people has been foisted upon us by government programs like the reserve system, and it's literally killing us. First Nations people on reserves have a diabetes rate five times that of other Canadians. So when it comes to what white allies can do, I would say something that they can do is supporting what's called food justice programs. Get informed about food justice issues, pressure governments to improve access to fresh, healthy food, both in First Nations communities that are on reserve and for some of the sort of unofficial First Nations communities that happen in most of the major cities across Canada. Something as simple as having a grocery store with fresh, affordable produce makes a huge difference in the life and health of the community.
That's some really good advice. Thank you so much, Margaret.
You're very welcome.
Yeah, as I said, I wish we had more time. Thank you so much for sharing your unique perspective and some Mi'kmaq legends. I'll post the original essay on our website for people to read.
An expanded version of it is coming up in the Canadian Journal of Native Studies.
Oh, good. Well, have a lovely day,
you too.
Thanks again.
Thanks very much.
Yeah, so that's about it for us today. I did want to recommend just another essay I found in my research that listeners might be interested in, Native Americans and Vegetarianism by Rita Laws, PhD, and she talks about, she's a Choctaw and Cherokee American Indian. She writes about, the history with farming and growing plants and that meat was just, you know, only a sometimes thing. And I guess, you know, it's different with every tribe, but she really spells it out nicely in that essay. So, yeah, I wanted to thank everyone for listening. Please do check out animalvoices.org. Next week on the show, we will have...
We'll be featuring Sharon Discofarno. She's an author of a recently published book called Remembering Pushkin. And we'll be speaking about grieving after the loss of a companion animal.
And I'm going to leave you with a song called Moose on the Tree Line. It's by Miss Emily Brown. She's a BC artist. And I wanted to thank Alon Cohen for your help with helping me put together the questions for that interview and your support with how to show solidarity with I Don't Know More.
Tattoo.